The next case this morning is Neff versus Capital Acquisitions.
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. In 1997, Mr. Neff had fallen behind on a Capital One credit card. Capital One calls him, offers to resolve the matter for $536. He pays it, writes on his payment instrument that it's payment in full, and thinks he's done with it. He hears absolutely nothing further for the next 5 years. No phone calls, no dunning letters, nothing. 5 years later, he receives a letter from Camco advising him that they have purchased his account and that he now owes nearly $3,000, the difference being interest, fees, and other charges imposed pursuant to the credit card agreement. Same story took place with Mr. Robb, except that a longer period was involved, and they demanded nearly $7,000 from him. Again, mostly interest and finance charges. This isn't supposed to happen. The Truth in Lending Act, which governs open-end accounts such as these credit card accounts, contemplates that the issuer of a credit card is to send a statement every month that a transaction occurs, a balance is outstanding, a finance charge is imposed. If you make a payment and it's not properly accounted for, you're required to have a billing dispute procedure. Each monthly statement is supposed to have an address. The consumer can write to that address, and while the matter is resolved, nothing adverse can be done with your credit. Defendants didn't follow any of these procedures. No monthly statements, no billing error procedure.
Apply to whoever issues a credit card as well as to subsequent owners of the account?
Yes, Your Honor. The defendant claims that there is a big hole in the truth in lending definition, that these obligations only exist with respect to an issuer, and that somebody who purchases a credit card account and enforces all the terms, including high interest rates and fees, they step into the shoes of the prior owner for purposes of determining their rights, but they somehow are able to get rid of all the liabilities, including the liability to have a billing error procedure and send monthly statements. Well, our position is that this hole is non-existent, and that the term issuer of a credit card is simply shorthand for the obligee. Conversely, the credit card holder is the obligor. The defendant seemed, in the district court, indicated that somehow the termination of credit card privileges, that is, the termination of the ability to voluntarily use the card to obtain additional property or services, alters their status. But the Federal Reserve Board has expressly addressed this in the regulation we quote in our brief, and it says it does not. The termination of the ability to get more credit pursuant to the agreement does not alter the obligation to send monthly statements and otherwise comply with the obligation of a credit card issuer.
Would the case be different if a credit card company were to send a final notice that your card is canceled and there be no further monthly statements?
The regulation specifies three events which terminate the obligation, these obligations. They file a collection lawsuit against you, you file bankruptcy, they formally determine that the account is uncollectible. The complaint alleges that they did not determine these accounts to be uncollectible, but sold it, which is the antithesis of uncollectible. They felt that some money could still be obtained on these accounts, and in both cases, the money was in fact paid. So the answer is no, unless they make that determination and then do nothing further. They don't sell it to someone else. In fact, there's an Internal Revenue Regulation. That determination would have certain tax consequences, and the Internal Revenue Service expressly says that if you continue in collection activity on an account or do packages for sale as part of a portfolio, as was done in this case, it is not uncollectible. It is deemed to be a collectible account. The district court and the defendant's argument turns entirely on an attempt to, in my view, manipulate the definition of credit card, namely a device for existing for the purpose of obtaining money, property, etc., and credit. The problem is that's a generic definition. It does not say anywhere in the statute that the credit device must, throughout its entire lifespan, permit the borrower, the consumer, to obtain additional money or property on credit. The regulation expressly says that it does not. Commonly, credit card and other open-end agreements have a credit limit. There's usually a durational requirement. It expires after some period. And it provides that if you fall behind, no longer have the ability to obtain additional credit. Federal Reserve Board addresses this situation and says you must continue to provide periodic statements and otherwise comply with your obligations. Other provisions of Truth in Lending make it clear that delinquency does not terminate the obligation to send monthly statements. For example, 1643 deals with legal proceedings to enforce a credit card, and 1666H also dealing with that subject. Those sections use the term card issuer. So you have a card issuer with respect to an account that's delinquent. And finally, I think it's very important, look at 1637, which is the basic source of the obligation. It says that the creditor of any account under an open-end consumer credit plan shall do certain things. These, neither the district court nor the defendants explain, are these no longer open-end credit accounts? Under the regulation, the only way these can become closed-end credit accounts, which is the only other kind of credit recognized, is by written agreement. There is no written agreement to that effect. And if the defendants are not the creditors, who is? Is it in one case Citibank and in the other case First Chicago, now defunct? I don't think so. It can't possibly comply with the 1637 application. None of these questions are answered, and I submit, Your Honor, that the issuer is simply the obligee of a credit card account trying to enforce it according to its terms, that there is no hiatus, there is no gap in the definitions. The defendants are card issuers. With respect to the other issue, count 7, I would just like to rest on my brief, and unless Your Honor has some questions, reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thanks,
Mr.
Allen. Mr. Moy?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The single and principal issue involved in this case is whether companies that acquire debt are creditor and do not issue additional credit to the original debtor are themselves creditors under TILA and therefore have to comply with the requirements in Section 1637. There is one other issue that Mr. Edelman referred to, which is also whether Capital One engaged in debt collection activity by reselling one of these debts to CAMCO. But the answer to both of these questions is no. In the first place, the creditor is a specifically defined term in TILA. It's not appropriate to look to IRS regulations. It's not appropriate to look to common law or statutory law of various states. Creditors are required to send these monthly statements described by Mr. Edelman, but they're not required to do so forever. There are certain specific instances where they can stop sending these statements. It is true that TILA's definition of creditor is not limited to the original holder of the account. However, for the other tests, and for the only test that plaintiffs say that applies here, it's necessary for plaintiffs to demonstrate that Capital One and CAMCO were card issuers. But the definition of card issuer supplied by TILA requires that some sort of credit be extended. Does not have to be pursuant to a credit card necessarily, could be pursuant to a coupon book, but some sort of credit must be extended to the appellant in order for the appellees to be considered card issuers.
You agree just, though, that I guess factually here that it's pretty unreasonable or unconscionable to settle a claim with a credit card company and think the deck is clear and then several years later get a bill for $3,000 or $7,000. It's outrageous, isn't it?
I don't think we're in a position to draw any sort of conclusions about that from the record here. Certainly that was the allegation. The plaintiffs are not complaining that the interest charged was inappropriate. They were not complaining that some form of contact other than these monthly statements should have been given to the debtors. They were only saying, and their only complaint in the, as far as the creditor definition goes, is that they were entitled to receive these monthly statements. Now, they weren't paying.
Well, I understand what the claim is. I'm just talking about a situation where you owe your credit card issuer $1,000 and you don't pay, and they contact you, and eventually you settle for $500. You write on the check payment in full, and then 3 years later you get a bill from somebody else that claims that you, they bought that account, and you now owe $3,000 or $7,000. Isn't that outrageous?
It is not. It is not because the specific provisions of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act provide for debt validation notices. I mean, they are
totally apart from the Act. It's still outrageous, isn't it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that this
unruffled, I say that. I would consider it outrageous if it happened to me.
Well, I think I personally would be upset too if it happened to me, Your Honor, but we have to look at what Congress has.
Yeah, no, no. I say, maybe no, we're not talking about. I don't want to ask for things. If somebody sends you a bill you've already paid, 7 years later you find out not only have they not credited you with paying the bill, but they stick you for the interest and a few other odds and ends in there, that I would be, let's say, quietly upset. I mean, I'd be more upset than that. But I mean, that has nothing to do with the law on the subject. It has to do with your reaction to it.
Well, I think we have to trust that Congress struck the best balance that it could.
Oh, it upsets Congress. I mean, Congress occasionally upsets me, but I mean, I'm not concerned about that. But the answer to Judge Evans' question, unless you're a wooden man, has to be yes. That would be upsetting.
And I think I've already said that. If I didn't make that clear, then I'll concede. Sure, it would be upsetting. But Congress has provided that this is a way to deal with.
You're not going to say it's illegal. You just say it's upsetting.
Exactly. And it's not the basis for a lawsuit either under
two different questions.
And it's not the basis for a lawsuit under either the Truth in Lending Act or the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. In fact, if I may, the appellees are not arguing that there's some sort of hole in TILA that specifically benefits companies in our position. I think the burden is on the appellant to show that there should be this additional burden. The appellants have conceded that many types of people who are extending credit are not entitled to get these monthly statements, for instance, closed-end credit. Now, in their reply brief, they suggest a reason, but that's not necessarily the reason Congress decided that debtors under closed-end credit are not required to get these monthly statements. And in fact, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, even under open-end credit, where the card remains with the original issuer, these things are not going to continue forever. If the debt goes into default, or a number of other things happen, there are three ways that Mr. Edelman alluded to in which the obligation to send these statements terminates. One of them is if the debt is uncollectible, another is if there's bankruptcy, and the other one skipped my mind, but I'll remember it in a second. The point is not that simply because a company is adding monthly finance charges that they're required to send these monthly statements. In the Truth in Lending Act and the Federal Reserve Board regulations, it is clear that where Congress and the Federal Reserve wanted to require subsequent assignees or subsequent holders of debt to provide statements, to provide disclosures, that they knew how to do so. They've done so. And these one of these places is referenced in our brief. Regulation Z provides, with regard to the question of whether these two companies should be required to send these statements, I also want to suggest an additional point that was not raised in our brief. But that is that these statements are costly to send. And in the case that we're addressing here, these are people that, by their own allegations, have not been paying these debts for many years, for 12 or 13 years. They're not paying. And I would suggest it is unreasonable to assume...
Well, that's not true as to one of these people. I said they pay.
That's the allegation
that... they got a bum, a bill here that they didn't deserve to cash.
That's the allegation that they both made. But they don't question that they haven't been paying any additional money under these accounts for many years, and according to the allegations of the complaint, both of the appellees believed that additional money was owed under these debts. So it's conflicting allegations on this point.
Well, you might be upset with the original credit card company if you got your company bought accounts that were actually closed.
Certainly, and that there might be a dispute between these two companies, and if one of these companies was doing something that the regulators did not approve of by selling accounts that were canceled, then maybe the regulators would have something to say about it. But the point I want to make is that it is not for Mr. Neff to say that there's a violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which does not specifically address this type of behavior. There's nothing in that statute that says that selling a debt where someone alleges that that debt has been canceled is a violation of the Act. And therefore, we don't think that a debtor like Mr. Neff should be in a position to decide what the obligations are. That job is left to Congress. And Congress has clearly provided that in closed-end credits, these statements are not required. In open-end credits, these statements are required, but only under certain circumstances. And unless a subsequent transferee also extends credit and therefore becomes a card issuer, there's no obligation for a subsequent transferee to send these sort of monthly statements. I want to make one more point about the case cited under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act section of the plaintiff's brief, the case out of the Ninth Circuit, the Magrin. As we stated in our brief, we think the Magrin case is too unreliable to be used as precedent here. There was virtually no discussion of the facts of that case, the allegations of the complaint, the basis for moving to dismiss, the basis on which the district court dismissed the case, and there's virtually no analysis provided by the Ninth Circuit on this point. In fact, we could even say that the Ninth Circuit simply looked at the statute, decided what it wanted to do without actually explaining how it got to this result. There's no reason to think that the debtors in these situations would be unprotected just because they're not getting these monthly statements. Because when and if an attempt is made to collect on these debts, they would get the debt validation notice required by the Credit Collection Practices Act. They can bring their concerns, if they have any, to the attention of the company that is trying to get them to pay. And it's clear from the allegations of the complaint here that neither of these two companies fit the definition of a credit card issuer. Although Capital One does issue credit cards, there's no allegation that any sort of credit was ever offered to Mr. Neff or Mr. Robb, and Camco doesn't offer any sort of credit at all.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 2 minutes, Mr. Elman.
Very briefly, Your Honor. There is no specific definition of issuer. The definition says a person who issues a credit card, an agent of such a person. Issue is the undefined term. It's a circular definition. I think that if you look at the statute and the regulations as a whole, what it means is the current obligee of a credit card obligation. There is nothing that requires that at all times during the life of a credit card obligation you be able to get additional credit. If you've used up your credit limit and somebody buys the first bank that you originally dealt with, I think the statute contemplates that you will get monthly statements from the successor bank. The reason for monthly statement requirements is to prevent exactly what happened here. You give the consumer a contemporaneous statement of the transactions under the account. You can then expect him, if there's something inappropriate, to step forward and use the billing error procedure. It wasn't done. The great cost of averted to by counsel is a red herring. The cost arises from the fact that they never bothered complying. Therefore, the matter was not resolved promptly, so they postulate that statements have to be issued over a period of years. That of course, is not what ought to have happened in this case. Finally, we allege that the specific situations, of which there's three in number, the third being a collection, institution of a collection lawsuit, and you can see sending statements did not occur. And finally, the concept of assignee is one peculiar to closed-end credit, where the terms, they're not supposed to be any subsequent transactions. The terms are set forth at the outset, and you get documents at the outset which ought to tell you whether exactly what your obligation is at any particular point in time. The concept is not one which is used in connection with credit other than open end, or is not one used with open end credit, only with closed end or credit other than open end.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be taken under advisement. We move to